Call the meeting to order. Looks like we have a quorum. And Representative Lanning, would you like to move the minutes?
I would love to.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Sorry, I was a couple minutes late. I was called to the principal's office.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did follow over here your instructions, however. I
yes,
want you
I
to
saw
know that.
we were just testing you.
Okay.
Okay, we have the Purpose Center for the Arts. Would you like to come up and get started? State your name for the record and get started. And welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the Capital Investment Committee, my name is Sue Mackert. I'm not the principal, but I do serve as Executive Director of the Purpose Center for Arts Education. And with me at the table is Bill Nash. He's the Purpose Center Building Maintenance Foreman. And I might add a recently elected member of the Spring Lake Park City Council. The Purpose Center for Arts Education is the state agency charged with advancing K-12 education in Minnesota schools by teaching in and through the arts. Legislation established the center in 1985 as the Minnesota School of the Arts and Resource Center. I'm going to get right to the heart of your business, and that is our capital bonding request. It's modest. It's $334,000 for asset preservation, $170,000 for repair of portion of the campus roadway and replacement of the main campus sign, $100,000 for design and installation of storm drainage. We're also working with Bassett Creek Watershed District, the City of Golden Valley, and the Met Council to provide some additional assistance for curbing our water runoff, and $64,000 to repair a loading dock. It's the only one on campus. The governor's budget supports our initial request of $263,000. Sometime after his budget was prepared and ours, a snowplow had an accident with our campus sign. So we've included the additional $71,000 for sign replacement and enhancement, taking into consideration insurance coverage. So that brings our total request to the $334,000, and there that is indicated in your packet of materials. So why would you support the Purpose Center for Arts Education? Achievement gaps, together with declining or elimination of art programs in schools, have generated greater demand today for services of the Purpose Center than any other time in the agency's history. 88% of school districts, representing 91% of the state's student population, have indicated a desire for added support from Purpose. These numbers are vital because we know that where we inspire and support teachers and administrators in breaking paradigms, changing teaching methods, incorporating best practices, and supporting a culture of assessment and accountability, that they are successful in addressing the systemic issues affecting student achievement. And that truly is and has always been our mission in focusing on improving student and teacher achievement in and through the arts. We have three major divisions. We have the Statewide Arts High School for juniors and seniors. We represent 100% graduation and 100% college placement for those wishing to go on to college. We are every day helping students focus to achieve and get an education and come back and work in Minnesota. And the other night I was at a function, and this gives you an idea of how we break paradigms and reach students. I was at a function and a father was pointing at me from across the way, and I'm sure you've been in those situations and you wonder why he's pointing at you. And he finally came over and he told me that his daughter, who's a senior at the Arts High School, is his fourth child and the only one to graduate from high school. His three other children did manage to finally get their GEDs. But not only is she graduating this spring, but she's been accepted at St. Cloud State's in their honors program in visual arts. And he was so grateful. And as we hear from so many parents of students attending the Arts High, as well as teachers we teach, that it is different, that we are reaching those systemic issues and thinkers. We have a program called Art Science. We are one of three sites in the United States that has been asked to be a part of that program. It's connected to Harvard, and what it does is bring the expertise, because we know that science and art are related, and so it's taking the concepts of science and the creativity of art and doing problem solving. There are 10 sites altogether, 3 in the U.S., the other 7 are international. We were so fortunate in connecting with the Mayo Clinic. They have a center for innovation that does exactly what we're teaching our students to do, and they were so impressed with our students and their presentation in art science that they have offered to mentor our students through this project. It is a project that's being incubated in the Arts High School, and eventually we will be able to move it out into the system for other K-12 high school students, that is. We have global exchanges, teaching students from Minnesota about other world cultures, because we think that as a school focused in the arts, it's very important for them to understand the context of history and how things began. We have a statewide library that serves as a full resource with curricular and other materials for teachers, administrators, teaching artists, and community members. And our professional development and research program, which really is the crux of full outreach through the state, is phenomenal. I love going to conferences and hearing teachers say that they are exhausted at the end of them, but also invigorated. I think of the 30-year veteran teacher who said, I have to send a note to all of my former students apologizing because I didn't understand that they think differently, and again, reaching those systemic issues to educate all students and really hit the achievement gap. We have an agreement with Bemidji State that allows teachers that attend a number of our workshops to receive graduate level credit. We have regional sites so that our funding is distributed throughout Minnesota. And with support from funds from the Cultural Arts and Heritage Act, we have developed a pilot project of arts integration, arts education integration with 9 school districts in and around the Fergus Falls area. The principal of Moorhead High School has been so verbal about the impact of student achievement that he hopes that we are working with their schools forever. We will be opening a second site this fall in southeastern Minnesota. So, out of respect for your time, that's all I wish to tell you. In your folder, there's more information. I would like to respond to any questions you have and wish you well as you come toward the mid-end of your session. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mackard. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you have $170,000 for the roadway, and then the sign, and you referenced the cost on the sign, and how much was that?
The sign, the approximate cost is $71,000.
For the sign?
Yes.
And the other question I have, you said a snowplow damaged it. Was that a public entity, or was it a private entity that damaged it? And if it's a public entity, then there wouldn't be an insurance issue, but if it was a private contract type of situation, they would have some liability.
Representative Carlson, we so tried to find out who hit that sign. And the tire tracks are quite large, but no one could remember having plowed that street that day. So, they have not come forward, and all we had were tracks. We did file a report with the local police department, but whether it was city, county, or private, they do not know, unfortunately.
That, Madam Chair, explains it. I understand your dilemma then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
I'll pass.
Oh, okay. Okay. Anyone else? Questions? All right. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate
very
it.
Much.
Thanks for being here. Next, Pollution Control Agency. When you're ready, go ahead and state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Myrna Hallbeck. I'm the Assistant Chief Financial Officer with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I'm here today to present our bond request that the governor has included in his bill. Our request comes in three parts. First, the capital assistance program, and I will talk about them in this order. The closed landfill program and the stormwater, which is a new grant program that we are requesting. Our total request is $18,388,000. First, let me talk about the capital assistance program. I do have the program manager here if we get into more detail, but I also want to recognize a couple of our county partners that are here. Mr. Steve Skoog, who is with Becker County, who coordinates and works with the Prairie Lakes Municipal Solid Waste Board up in the northwest part of the state, and John Mitchell and Brian Sams with Redwood County, who work more in the south central part of the state. So a couple of their projects are projects that we're recommending that you include in this grant bonding process because they're critical to their areas. First, just a little history of the capital assistance program, which began in 1980 with the passage of the Waste Management Act. That act really encouraged counties to develop an integrated solid waste management system, of which recycling centers, mixed municipal incinerators, reuse centers are all a component of that. The goal is to reduce the waste that goes to landfilling, and that will connect with the closed landfill program, as you'll see. But this program is the preventative side of really having to clean up landfills and such after we bury it in precious ground. It also became a catalyst for regional cooperation as the counties and their efforts become eligible for more assistance as they regionalize and do it, which becomes a more efficient system through the work that we're doing. Just a quick reminder that the request for this program is $5.6 million, which will suffice to probably support five different projects that we have. What we did in 2012, because the program is meant to get the bonding and then go out for the RFP, so we did an informal request to counties and folks who work in the solid waste area just to see if they had projects that we thought might be reasonable and would be ready if we were to obtain bonding. So that's really how we have it. We know the projects are solid. Timing of exactly when they start and to move will be a little bit adjusted once we would do the grant request to do it. I think it's important to notice how much your bonding leverages. So of 94 state grants we've issued for a total of $61 million, there's been $207 million that the local entities have used of their funding to move this. Additionally, all the locals support all the operation and maintenance of the program, so they really are invested into these systems. We're helping support the infrastructure much the same way with municipalities we support the wastewater infrastructure. This really is the backbone of the solid waste system in Minnesota, and so we feel it important to do it and carry on. In this map, you'll see the areas that responded to us, again, that had continual interest. Really, while it looks like there are five or six areas, these support more than 12 counties, and really the secondary effects are much larger than that. So in Becker County, the Prairie Lakes really supports 12 counties almost by itself by the activities it does to do. The Redwood County Recycling Center will become a joint effort with Renville County, and Redwood has a success in its recycling program of 86%. Right now, Renville is about 36%, so they believe if they join together, they'll both benefit from these activities to do. So I thought it would be good just to give you an impression of what our counties are working in, and these are actual facilities that one of our Western Lake Superior is actually dealing with their reuse center out of the back of a roll-off. And as materials come in, they try to fit them into those roll-ons. So what they're looking for is really a facility that helps encourage that and manage it to do. In the other two pictures, you'll see the some of our counties are working in almost double garages, sometimes maybe a triple garage if they're lucky. And those types of pole situations are not meant for pushing up against them to load waste and recyclables in. So we have the walls are now pushing out to do it, and we also have rats and infestation. We have electrical issues in them, and really kind of unsafe conditions that we're asking you to help support, manage the infrastructure of these counties. The next slide provides you a sense of what the projects would cost, what they would be eligible for from the CAP grant request, and then what their costs would be in the program. And as you see, an investment by us turns around as an investment by the locals. And they also do have what we have termed job growth, but we're talking about permanent job growth. The transfer facility in Renville already has staff, so that's just a moving of it. As we expand the other areas, they will add staff to help manage the additional waste to do. So in a summary for the capital assistance, we're requiring $5.6 million. All of these counties and their efforts really move the waste up the hierarchy, which we want to reduce, recycle, reuse the waste before we either burn it in an incinerator or use landfilling. Its prevention is often cheaper, and you'll see that as we move into the closed landfill program. Really is supporting the infrastructure much the same way we support municipal wastewater infrastructure, and it maintains jobs within those local areas. With that, Madam Chair, I thought I'd stand for questions on this, since each is kind of a program itself, that should you have questions on this before I move on.
Questions from the members, anyone? Proceed to the next section then, I guess.
Okay. With this next section, what we're going to do is move to the back end of the solid waste hierarchy. So what happens when you don't do the prevention side, you end up with the cleanup side. And we've been working on this program since 1994. At that time, we had over 50 sites that were listed on the state and federal Superfund. And what was happening in other states, not yet here in Minnesota, individuals were being sued to help clean up those old landfills. As a society, we buried in those landfills. We didn't, as a state, think that was appropriate, so in 94 we created the closed landfill program, of which we are nearing completion of the closure of these covers and activities. And I think that's a successful program. We've been able to recover some land in some cases when we brought small landfills together into one and put the land back to use. In the other cases, we have really protected groundwater and citizens that are near these landfills. And as I describe the three-way landfill later, you'll see the need for this. We have about five sites left to be constructed. This request is for $10 million and is only for the Flying Cloud landfill. The types of activities that we do when we're constructing and rebuilding these are reestablishing good cover on them. Sometimes we find waste that should not be buried in these landfills and we remove it. We have special waste like asbestos that needs particular care about it. We relocate the waste, which we've done in a number of cases, and you'll see that we'll be doing that in the Flying Cloud landfill as well. We end up with groundwater treatment, gas extraction, and then the cover installation to the best practical systems we have. We also then have an ongoing operation and maintenance cost of about $4.5 million, which would be funded through our remediation fund, not through bonding requests. So this slide shows the remainder of our active construction, and again, Flying Cloud would start construction this fall should we receive the bonding request. The Hopkins landfill is intended to start this fall, and that really is in being considerate of the nearby homeowners who, when we open this landfill and move the waste around it, will be quite odorous, and so you want to do it in the cooler weather parts of our months to keep that odor down and manage it. And so we have really worked the time frame out with the locals in that area to do it. Kuchiching will begin this spring, and East Mesaba is already started and will finish up this year. So we really are very much nearing the end of our construction needs in this program. There will be one landfill left, and that landfill is not yet in the program, and that's in Burnsville, and that landfill could be $56 million a month. But we'll manage that and come to you as if it indeed comes into the program. So Flying Cloud. Flying Cloud is about 240-acre site. It's right across from the Flying Cloud landfill. And as you look at this, you'll see a number of development homes that are now there that have continued to grow. And the highest risk is really gas movement to those homes. And so we really need to manage this in a thoughtful way. It has inadequate slopes. Its waste footprint right now is 87 acres. We intend to shrink that. We have differential settlement that's going on, which means the water's ponding right on the landfill, which creates a larger discharge to groundwater. The gas issues need to really be addressed because of the differential settlement. It's actually breaking the piping in the settlement and for our gas system, and therefore that creates a greater risk that gas will just migrate off-site to the homes. So again, this slide just shows the cover, and it is hard to see, but there are some blue circles there where we're beginning to see the ponding and the settlement, and we want to manage that quickly. So what we will do is actually peel back the topsoil that exists and not waste that, so it will be used again for it. We'll consolidate the waste footprint down. We'll re-slope the cover so we have better control of the drainage. We'll put a synthetic cover on it so that we can actually push the gas to our collection system and not have it escape into the air. We'll install a brand new gas collection system, and then you see the area with permanent grass. So this actually shows how we will condense the acreage from the current 87 acres. It will take 57 acres, so we'll move the waste from the 30 acres, condense it. Eventually down the road, those 30 acres may be usable land again to be put into production, which we have done at some of our other landfill sites.
Ms. Harbach, I have a question.
Sure.
With the gas collection, there's one of those in my city, and what's done with the gas that's collected? Where does it go?
Well, we always hope that we collect enough gas so that we can convert it into energy, electrical energy. In some cases, we'd like to be able to clean it up and use it for steam. We have a couple of sites in the Northwest that are actually looking at the possibility of doing it and using it to heat their recycling center, so there's some effort. If it really doesn't support that activity, unfortunately, we just have to burn it off. But it is, our goal is always to turn it into another energy source.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hallback, I have a question on the gas collection and the burning off and so forth. And if a private entity were to do this, would they need a permit to do this from MPCA?
Ms. Harbach.
I think at this point I'll have to bring Jeff Lewis up, who actually manages the program for that.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Lewis. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jeff Lewis, and the last name is L-E-W-I-S, and I manage the Coles Landfill Program at NPCA. Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, for the larger systems, they do trigger a requirement for an air permit for the amount of gas that they burn. Out of the Coles landfills that we have two of them that are large enough that we actually have to go through the same permitting process. But it's only for the extremely large. There are a number of the still open landfills that are also burning methane generation off of them, and a number of those are large enough to trip that.
Representative Fabian?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm just curious to know, is the permitting process the same then for you, I'll say, for the MPCA permitting itself as it would be if it were permitting for a county or a private?
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, yeah, we actually go through the same type of monitoring, providing information on the constituents that are in the gas that we're burning, and then the efficiencies of the four systems that we operate. We pretty much get almost 100% destruction of the landfill gases through the flare systems that we operate. And we have 21 different sites where we operate gas collection systems with flares.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Further questions? All right, continue, Ms. Hubbard.
So again, just a quick reminder that the projected cost for the Flying Cloud landfill is $18 million. Our bond request is $10 million, and the remainder of $8 million would come from the remediation program. And this was always intended to be a shared program, bonding, insurance recovery, and then the remediation fund. And so it has historically done, the insurance recovery program is complete. And so it's really left to the bonding and the remediation fund at this point. Again, we will complete with this by 2015 all of our construction projects except for the freeway landfill in Burnsville. And really, we have the faster we can move, as of course with the gas prices and all of that, it increases the cost of our construction as well. And so continuing at what we're going will reduce the long-term cost of doing this. And it does create construction jobs. Washington alone for the 3 period that we did that had 50 jobs associated. So it does keep our construction workers in jobs.
Okay.
And that would be it unless there's some more questions relative to this.
It doesn't look like there is. Anyone?
So our last request before you, as you consider your bonding thing, is a new stormwater pond restoration grant program. And this really is, again, an infrastructure issue for our municipalities in controlling the risk of flooding, even the localized events, and preventing the delivery of contaminated sediment from reaching our rivers and streams. We really work with our municipalities. As some of you know, we do the permitting part of that as well, but we also provide technical assistance and opportunities to help them manage their materials in a solid formation. So our goal here is to offset the significant cost to counties, the burden for them. The range for managing the sediment in their ponds can be anywhere from $75,000 to $125,000 per pond, depending on what those sediments are contaminated with. You know, whether it be heavy metals that are coming, and can it be used at a landfill as cover material, or does it have a more serious contamination and we have to manage it in a different way and be burying it? So we really want to do the preventative side as well. And as you know, we have a great deal of effort to work with municipalities on that and keep the water on the land instead of in the ponds and in the basins. So whether you're constructing, whether you're an industrial site, we really try to work with municipalities to manage that. We believe after this program is gone, municipalities will really be able to manage their infrastructure themselves. But we have had significant growth in the cities, faster than we anticipated. Our construction and industrial stormwater programs are really getting off the ground now, so the prevention, keeping that soil on the land, and really for industries to keep their materials from being connected to rainfall and snow melt and then having anything run off of their property, they're really being aggressive in managing that. So we expect to see less of these contaminants in it. But a sediment pond is based to, you know, collect sediment and any of the contaminants with it.
So Excuse me, Mrs. Hallbeck. Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Hallbeck. Regarding the stormwater pond restoration grant program, does that have, are you finding the PAHs in those ponds? And I just recently saw something from Jet Black that they're no longer going to use coal tar. And is this part of your what you're anticipating you'll have to be helping the communities with? There's, what, 20,000 of these ponds in the metro area or in Minnesota?
Ms. Hallbeck?
Could you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, that indeed would be part of the eligibility requirement. So we are looking, when we do a grant program, we set up eligibility for that. PAHs absolutely are found in some of the ponds, but it's not solely meant to take just PAH-contaminated soils, but heavy metals, those ponds that are filling, so they're no longer keeping the capacity there for the water. But PAHs are there, and the activity that Jet Black is doing will help us all.
Representative Scalzi.
And just as a follow-up then, are you, we had a bill some a couple of years ago regarding this, but at that point the communities had to have an ordinance on record that would prevent the use of coal tar. Is any of that at this point a requirement for eligibility to prevent further contamination?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, it probably would be a factor in it, but not the only requirement. So it is not based on that. But for instance, if they had an ordinance, often when we do grants, we have a way to give people a higher score based on activities they're doing. So that's some of those activities that we'd look at.
Continue on.
As the program is looking at it, we're looking at a 50% match and a max of $250,000 per pond in it. We're, since this is a program just getting off the ground, we're really looking at an introductory amount of a little over $2.7 million to do it. And from that first effort, then you learn a lot when you're running grant programs on really how to manage it, make sure that statewide have equal access to the money. That's what we do in all of our programs. So this first part is really helping us set up with the program, understand those costs better, and understand what the municipalities need in more detail.
Ms. Hallbeck, is this grant program in statute now?
Mr. Chair, we have the ability to issue grants and under many activities, it's a matter of whether we do bonding. It's not a specific grant authorized or mandate to the agency.
So, Ms. Dyson, does that help our question? Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, and I'll probably follow up with the agency and with MMB, because in the past we've had to have the grant program criteria and items in statute for purposes of bonding, and maybe this is something that can be worked out, but I just wanted to find out because I wasn't aware of this program and wanted to find out what we would be citing.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, we have worked this, as we work with any of them, through MMB, and they did not ask us for those specifics, so I'd be glad to talk more with you and MMB on as we proceed.
Please do that, yeah.
Next, I just have a couple of slides quickly just for the to help with the kind of issues of concern that municipalities often deal with, including the complaints from citizens when their ponds are not working as well, and the excess growth from nutrients. So we see that. Also blocked pipes, flooding activities that will come from it, direct contact of exposure when you have contaminated sediments, including in the flooding area where it may have backed up into homes and the other activities to do. And lastly, you'll be able to see out into the lake the brownish color that's coming, and that's really the sediment that can no longer be stored in the pond when we have housing developments that quickly have grown up faster than the pond was intended to manage the soils off of that. Again, just a quick summary that we're requesting a little bit over $2.7 million in general obligation. This is a brand-new program, so we haven't requested it previously. There really is a high cost to treating the sediment to our municipalities with it, which becomes, you know, as anything else, a strong disincentive. It's important as an infrastructure component in the municipalities for flood control as well as water quality to do. We will support this through our staff with our funding, not through the bond dollars. So we're not anticipating any of the bond dollars going to staffing. The technical assistance will be done with environmental funds to do it. And we think that's important to continue to work with the municipalities to find the least costly options that they have to manage it. And with that, I'll close. Any further questions from
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbach, you said that you're not going to use any staff. I'd like to repeat that. Is that just for this section, just the stormwater pond restoration, the dollars there, or is it for all three of the requests that you're making?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's actually true for all three requests.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself for the tape, and we'll get started.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the Chief Financial and Operating Officer with the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today to share Department of Human Services bonding request for 2012. You should have a handout in front of you, a set of slides that looks something like that. It's coming around. Got it now, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I'd like you to start on the second page, just giving you an overview of the four requests that the Department of Human Services has. These are the dollar amounts that have been included in the governor's recommendation on bonding, totaling $47.3 million for 2012. The first priority is for the Minnesota Security Hospital. This is in St. Peter, and this is a $40 million request for design construction within that facility. The second request is also in the St. Peter campus. This is for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and this request is for pre-design and design. You can see with both of these first two requests that these are multi-year requests, that this is a staged project over, in the case of the Security Hospital, two bonding cycles. In the case of the Sex Offender Program, we anticipate three bonding cycles. You can see the estimated numbers in the out years for what we think it'll take to complete this project. I'll spend quite a bit of my time today talking about the St. Peter campus and what we're trying to do there. These are two projects that are really intertwined together in terms of our vision of where we want to move on the St. Peter campus. The third request we have is a system-wide asset preservation of $2.5 million. We have buildings across the state. We have an asset preservation list of over $18 million at this point. This will help us to work down on that list. And then finally, our fourth request is for early childhood facilities of $3.1 million. This is a request that is done through an RFP in statute, and I'll talk a little bit more about that toward the end of the presentation. We have three objectives that we're trying to accomplish on the St. Peter campus with this bonding request. First, we have critical patient and staff safety issues in the security hospital now. We believe that those are in part due to the physical layout of the building, and I'll talk a little about that and show you some pictures of what that building looks like. We believe we need to address those issues for the benefit of both our patients and our staff, but also to help with patient treatment and to create a better therapeutic environment for the patients in that hospital. Secondly, we need to separate the vulnerable population from the sex offender population on the St. Peter campus. We have two populations we're serving on the St. Peter campus. The first is the sex offender population, which folks tend to be more familiar with, and the second are folks who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. And I'll talk a little bit more about those two populations. Right now, those two populations are intermingling on the lower campus of St. Peter. Both populations, members in both populations, have campus privileges. We don't believe this is a situation that we should be moving forward with, and we should try to physically separate those populations. Finally, to address the sex offender, the growth in the sex offender program, we'd like to build flexible capacity for MSOP where it's needed, which is at the end stage of treatment. The end stage treatment in the sex offender program is on the St. Peter campus, not on the Moose Lake campus. That's why we're focusing our bonding requests there. As I mentioned, there are two populations that we serve on the St. Peter campus, and I think that it's important to understand the distinction between these two populations. The second one listed here is the one I think folks are more familiar with because they tend to be out in the papers more, and also I think this committee has dealt with the sex offender population over time in terms of bonding requests. These are people who are committed to the department as sexual predators, sexually dangerous persons. They are usually committed to us out of the correction system, someone who's completed their prison sentence. There's a review of the individual that happens by the county attorney, and there's a petition made to have that person civilly committed to us. The population that is identified in number one on this slide is a population that's also civilly committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. Many of these individuals are also in the criminal justice system, not all of them. But many of them are the individuals who may be found guilty or not guilty by reason of mental illness are then committed to the department. Some are committed to us for evaluation after they've committed a crime or been alleged to have committed a crime. And some of them are also committed out of DLC. The one thing to understand about these two populations, what I think folks know about the sex offender population, is that we just provisionally released the first person, actually the second in the time we've had the program, but the first in quite a while this week, yesterday as a matter of fact. It's been a program that people have stayed in and the population has built. Within the security hospital population, the mentally ill and dangerous population, this is a population where there is turnover. We have people moving through this program all the time. We're able to treat them, get them stabilized, put them in a position where they can transition back to the community, often with support, sometimes with supervision, depending on their own individual circumstances. But the average stay in the security hospital is 8 years, and we think actually we can reduce that stay if we make changes in the program. This is a map of the St. Peter campus. If you draw a horizontal line across this map, right where under where it says St. Peter campus, that would show you where the Minnesota River Bluff is. At the top of the slide is the part of the campus that's on the top of the hill, and at the bottom where you see the collection of buildings at the bottom of the hill, they're actually physically separated if you go and look at the campus. The top of the slide, the big building in red, that is the security hospital. That's where the security hospital is currently located and where we would propose to do some remodeling, renovation, and additional building. The lower part of the campus, you'll see, is a mixture of buildings coated in different colors. The red buildings are currently housing some of the population from the security hospital. These are the folks who are mentally ill who are committed to us, who are serving in that program. The blue buildings are serving the sex offender population. And these are the folks who are toward the end treatment within the sex offender program. And the green building are shared buildings. As I mentioned earlier, one of our goals for the St. Peter campus is to get to the point where we have physically separated these two programs, where the security hospital population in our final plan would be all up on top of the hill, where you see the big security hospital building now, and the sex offender program would be on the bottom part of the hill in the existing buildings, with some shared buildings that would be just of an administrative nature, not shared buildings that would actually share a program or where the populations would be mixed together. I mentioned at the beginning that one of our key objectives with this is to address safety and security issues within the security hospital itself. This is an interior shot of one of the living areas within the Minnesota Security Hospital. This is the place where we serve the folks who are committed to us for being mentally ill. This was really not a facility that was designed for therapeutic treatment or to help patients transition back into the community. It was really designed for safety. And certainly we need to have a safe and secure environment for serving this population. But as you can see, this environment really contributes to some of the safety issues with the narrow stairways, the poor sight lines, and the difficulty for the staff to be able to see what's going on when they're sitting at the nurse's station looking down the hall, where they can't see around the corners or see up the stairs about what's going on with patients. This also contributes to some of the anxiety for patients who are in recovery, who are equally sometimes concerned about what's around the corner or what's up the stairs. Additionally, patients who are on psychotropic medication often have difficulty managing stairs, so just the existence of having stairways in the living areas is not really a terribly good idea. We believe that this is contributing to the environment that's creating staff safety issues, patient safety issues in the program, and we'd like to renovate that to make it look more like the next slide. This is what a secure hospital for serving the mentally ill should look like. This is actually a picture taken in our Anoka facility. Wide hallways, well lit, good sight lines from the nurse's station, no stairs. This is the kind of environment we'd like to create in St. Peter, which we also think would help in terms of creating an environment that would be more conducive for treatment of the individuals that we're serving in that program. This is just a close-up of the lower campus, and as I said before, you can see here that we have the two buildings, Bartlett and Johnson Hall, which are currently serving patients from the Minnesota Security Hospital. Essentially, and as you can see on opposite ends of the campus with the sex offender program in between them, individuals in both the sex offender program and on the lower campus in the security hospital program, some of them have campus privileges, meaning that they can go out and walk around, some supervision depending on the level of the individual's need. But we don't believe that it's a good idea to have these two populations mixing together in this campus, which is why in our end analysis, the two buildings that are shown here in red with the current security hospital population, we would move those populations up to the upper campus and serve the upper campus area as the area where we'd serve all the people who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous, and reuse Bartlett Hall, which you can see circled here in red, and also the green building right underneath it, which is Sunrise, to help to renovate and use those as additional beds for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So it's a way to try to tie together a number of goals we have for the St. Peter campus, both building a more safe and secure, therapeutically appropriate environment in the security hospital, as well as separating the two populations we're serving, and then finally creating capacity through remodeled beds in remodeled space rather than building new space, which would be more expensive, for the sex offender program to address the growth that we see coming in that program. Specifically, what we're proposing for the security hospital with the $40 million is proposed in 2012. First, design and build a new 24-bed secure admissions unit. When patients first come to us when committed as mentally ill and dangerous, they are often in a very unstable situation. And there's a period of time they need to be hospitalized. We need to work with them, usually on medications as well as other issues, to address behavioral issues and make sure that they are stabilized to a point where they can move in and start living with the general population. We don't have that kind of facility to do that, and this kind of secure 24-bed hospital that would be separate from the main building would be a way to ensure that we can keep sort of the flow of treatment from the initial admission to the first stages of treatment to the end stages of treatment within the security hospital. We'd renovate and eliminate all those split-level units I showed you the picture of earlier, basically flatten those out and make them look more like that second slide, so we'd have a wide hallway and a kind of environment which would be more secure and well-lit and open. And we'd also, in the first phase, build 80 residential beds on the upper campus for transitional housing. As I mentioned at the beginning, many of the folks who are committed to us in mentally endangered do get stabilized, do get treatment, are to get to the point where they are able to transition back to the community. We need to have the appropriate kind of living to help them get adjusted for making that transition. So this would be to build more apartment-like housing for them on the upper campus as a way to provide that kind of space. This is also the way we free up those beds we're currently using on the lower campus to make them available to be remodeled for the sex offender program. As you can also see then, as I mentioned earlier, in the second phase in 2014, we construct additional residential and programming space. This next slide shows the census projections for the security hospital population. The issue with the security hospital is not so much a census-driven kind of approach. We're really trying to address creating the right kind of environment that is safe for our staff and for patients and provides the right kind of treatment environment. In fact, our hope is that by making adjustments in the program that include programmatic adjustments as well as the physical plant changes we're talking about, that we can actually shorten the stay of the current 8-year stay of folks in this program to 6 years, which actually might change this trend line to be more toward flat. So that's not the main driver of the of our remodeling request in the security hospital. This gives you a graphic representation or a map representation of what we would do in the first phase of the remodeling on the security hospital. What is listed here in H and the pink kind of big area in the middle, that's the existing security hospital that would not be changed. The sort of red areas you see toward the end, the smaller red areas, those are areas that would be remodeled, and then the yellow are new construction areas. So if you look at the yellow areas that are labeled G, kind of sticking out of the end of the large building, those are those living units that I showed before that we propose to basically renovate into being a single-story, flat kind of living area, which would be more conducive to treatment than the split-level arrangement we have now. E, this little separate building you see sort of toward the top of the slide, that's the admissions hospital that I talked about earlier. And the buildings that are scattered to the right that are labeled F, that's the residential transitional housing space. What this gets us toward is a treatment flow from admission to the first part of treatment to the transition out into the community, which would be through those buildings that you see labeled F. This is just a conceptual model of what this might look like. It's not exact locations or size of the buildings we would actually build in the first phase, but this is the idea of what we'd like to get toward. The second priority, which as I've talked about and is very related to our first priority, is around the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And this request is not for construction, but for pre-design and design to remodel Bartlett Hall and the Sunrise Building to create additional space for the Sex Offender Program. Construction for this would begin in 2014 or 2016, so you can see that this is part of our phased approach. The next slide is a different story than what we saw with the security hospital population. The needs in the sex offender program are driven by the census and by the increasing number of people, individuals that we will be serving, we project will be serving, over the next 8 years. Projecting a population growth of about 55 or 60 a year. As I said before, these are individuals that are committed to us by the courts. We have to serve them when they're committed to us and provide them with treatment. Part of what we're trying to do with this proposal by remodeling on the St. Peter campus and doing it in phases is to have some flexibility in how many beds we're building. We have the capacity to build as many as 200 additional beds on the St. Peter campus. Right now, the sex offender program has enough beds for under the current projections to get us through 2014. The additional 200 beds would get us to about 2018. We want to build flexibly because we are still hopeful that there will be some more discussion about how to address this trend line in the sex offender program and whether there are better ways to treat individuals, whether so many individuals need to come into the program, and whether some more can be moved to the community. Those discussions have been ongoing, but we have sort of a dual obligation. Well, on the one hand, we want to move toward a program that makes more sense from a fiscal standpoint in how we serve sex offenders. We also need to be prepared for what the current law anticipates. And under current law, we anticipate we're going to have 55 to 60 additional sex offenders each year to serve through this program. next slide summarizes some of what I've said, that we are out of beds by 2014. As I mentioned earlier, the St. Peter campus is where we want to do the expansion of the sex offender program, not at Moose Lake, because we believe we need more capacity toward the end stage of the treatment. Moose Lake is where folks first come into the program. As they progress and are making progress, that's when they move down to St. Peter, which is a program that works more toward the community integration.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering what kind of an effect changing the law to, you know, make sex offender sentences longer, what that would do to your program. If we doubled their sentences, what would that do as far as the demand on the number of beds that you need?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it would do, it would probably do something in the longer term. In the short term, it wouldn't do very much. We tend to get the people committed to us after they've completed their sentence in the department of, in the prison, in the Department of Corrections. Those individuals that have already been sentenced and have a sentence that's already in law, their sentence ends when it ends, and you can't double their sentences going. But going forward, it would make a difference in terms of having fewer people or a longer delay before people would get to us. And again, might vary a little bit depending on what kind of treatment they received when they were in the correction system.
Representative Switzinski.
Mr. Chair, this question maybe is more general, but have you folks in particular or other agencies looked at existing facilities potentially in the state that may be mothballed for use? Thinking out in south western Minnesota, we have a facility that's sitting empty, Appleton, which has been used in the past but is now sitting empty. You know, we talked about putting $5 million into a fence around a prison in Shakopee, and I'm wondering what a facility like that would potentially sell for as a whole as it's sitting empty. Just some general thoughts. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Johnson. Representative, we have looked at other alternatives, and I think part of what we're trying to do here is actually an alternative to where we were a couple years ago, which was to build more beds at Moose Lake. And building at St. Peter does allow us to use existing buildings, remodel those buildings rather than building brand new beds. As far as looking at other facilities, one of our concerns is not to have too many places where we're serving the population and to try to use the Moose Lake and the St. Peter as the two nexuses of where we're working with this population. And so that's part of the concern, is just the efficiency and also the transportation and other things that go on if you're in too many different places. So that was one of the concerns. If you want specifically to the Appleton facility, I could have someone try to address that, but I haven't personally looked at that.
Representative Swedzinski, you probably stirred the sleepy giant. Representative Ward.
No question about it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Swedzinski. That's leads. I've been patiently waiting, but I'm going to jump in now. Thank you. Mr. Johnson, just a couple quick questions. I represent District 12A right now, District 10A, neighbor of Representative Halls right now. He's very familiar with the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center campus. You are as well? Okay.
Yes.
So, Mr. Johnson, you know, it really, for those members that don't know, we have a Region Treatment Center in Brainerd that had approximately 16, 17 buildings, of which 12 of them, about 12 of them, have now been demoed. Excellent, wonderful buildings, just like you're talking about, Representative Swedzinski. And we still have five or six remaining. Three of them house programs, and three of them are still very, very well-constructed, very fine buildings that could be used. And Representative Hollis, you're absolutely right. I have repeatedly talked to the governor, to Commissioner Jessen, to some folks sitting out here about reuse in Emptyville. Matter of fact, I had legislation passed saying DHS, you can't build until you look at. 2 years ago, Representative Swedzinski, we had a bill. I passed the legislation that said you can't build until you look at vacant buildings in the state. And it was law. It was in a bill that passed. I'm not sure whatever happened with that. So you made a statement that Representative Swedzinski said, you know, fiscally we're trying to back up having them all in either Moose Lake or St. Peter. And you have data that shows that's, you know, that's fiscally, you know, going to save or save the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I don't. I'm going to turn and see if anyone in the audience wants to address that. Dennis Payne.
Mr. Chair,
state your name for the
Representative Ward and members. My name is Dennis Benson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. A couple of points. We have done a pretty thorough and comprehensive analysis as part of a legislative study, I believe it was 2 years ago, that required that we do look at other facilities in addition to Moose Lake and St. Peter. And it really is a fiscal problem. If we have a population of 650 people, and to locate those folks at two campuses is a stretch. We have two infrastructures at Moose, an infrastructure at Moose Lake, an infrastructure at St. Peter, in other words, a director, a maintenance staff, another fence, another security system. So you're duplicating this every time you go to another site. And that's what raises this per diem. Our per diem, you know, like we go to other committees and we get dinged because our per diem is $300 a day. And it's that kind of thing that really drives the per diem. Might be cheaper to move into an empty building, but that's a fraction of the cost when you consider the operational cost year after year after year. So that economy of scale is really the best way to bring those operational costs down. And with a population of just 650, we would be well advised. In an ideal world, we'd have them all on one campus. We have prisons that are 2,000 beds. So to have them at two separate campuses is enough of a cost driver, but to actually go to a third site would bring that per diem much, much higher than the current $300 a day. And we're trying to do that, as Chuck mentioned a moment ago, use these older buildings at St. Peter. We 2 years ago, we're here talking about building another $35, $40 million, 400-bed unit at Moose Lake. And that got met with lots of resistance. And I think we were well advised to go back and take a look at policy, and we continue to look at policy. There seems to be some growing interest in trying to manage these costs through some curbing of the policy as well, which I think we should continue to have that dialogue. But in the meantime, I think this is a fiscally responsible plan that makes use of existing buildings. We would do some light remodeling. But for this population, and as you know, we heard again today, there seems to be more and more interest in trying to sentence our way out of this civil commitment problem. And if that's the choice that policymakers want to make, certainly we'll do that. We'll have more people in prison, but this program then would start to level off, and we wouldn't need those new beds. So I think the plan that Mr. Johnson has laid out is fiscally responsible. It buys us a little time. If there are going to be some policy adjustments in the next year or two or three, we can go a different direction. We're going to have to accommodate growth for probably the next 5 to 10 years, even if we do make some sentencing policy changes, because they're in the pipeline. There are about 2,000 to 3,000 sex offenders in prison that will ultimately be considered for civil commitment. So anything we did around sentencing wouldn't kick in until those people are all through the funnel.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Benson, thank you. I think the answer to my question is no, you don't have any fiscal information, but you have some hypothetical fiscal information that you're going on. As I look at this, it says design and build a new 24-bed security admissions unit. That's a new building. That's a new unit. It says renovate, build residential space, 80 relocated beds for transition programs. That's a new unit. So really, Mr. Benson, with all due respect, you're building new. You're building new. And if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. The fact of the matter is, I don't know what Representative Swinski has in his district, but I know in my district we have at least three buildings that would be very, very adequate. And I actually have suggested to the governor, to Commissioner Jessen, to others that will listen, maybe, that, you know, that we, being fiscally responsible, and I get what you're saying about operational expenses as well. But in fact, you know, once you build these new buildings, you're going to have those same operational expenses. And that's why I asked, you have hard data to back up what the statements that you're making. So I would members, I just hope that, you know, I know there's some economic instructors over there and some high school and college economic instructors, and, you know, all of us are trying to be fiscally responsible. You know, that we do take exactly what, in a bipartisan manner, matter of fact, Representative Sudinski and Representative Ward are talking about here. Because I believe that we can do this as well, more fiscally responsible. Down in your area, Representative Sudinski, and in my area as well. And not only that, we can also provide some significant job development, creation, and retention in our areas that probably both of us significantly need as well. So, members, I just wanted to make those points, and thank you. The sleeping giant did wake, and I will be talking about that as much as I can. Thank you for your information. I do appreciate it, but I hope you also heard, you know, my feedback as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stop right now.
Thank you. Mr. Betson, could you tell us what the per diem per day is in when they're incarcerated in prison, just so the members know that?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's the high 80s, $87, $86 a day.
You used to work there, didn't you, Mr. Benson? So you'd have a good estimate.
Mr.
I mean,
Chair,
close.
Yes, I
okay.
Spent 34 years there.
Okay, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first question just has to do with the civil commitment portion of it. And I think if I heard you correct, you said you have about 200 beds and the average length of stay is about 8 years, and I was just wondering how many of those people are ever recommitted to the program, or if once their 8 years is up, then they're done.
Mr. Johnson, you want that, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the answer to the recommit question. I don't know, do you have it, Tom?
State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and Representative, my name is Thomas Reuter, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And if I understand your question correctly, you're asking about if people are recommitted from the Minnesota Security Hospital? Okay. So when an individual is released from the Minnesota Security Hospital, they go through the Special Review Board process, and the Special Review Board makes a recommendation to the Commissioner of Human Services for release of that individual, and it's a reduction in custody. That person maintains a provisional discharge for the length of their civil commitment. What that means is that any particular time when that person has been released within transition services or released within the community, if that person is starting to fail, the Minnesota Security Hospital can pull that person back in for treatment. It's very similar to parole that the Department of Corrections uses in that sense. There are instances where the individual and the individual's attorney, after having been out in the community for a length of time, can request a discharge of their provisional discharge. And at that point, the civil commitment process would have been completed and ended if the court grants that discharge of the civil commitment process. So in answer to your question, it's a complicated answer to your question, but what it essentially means is that most individuals are on a provisional discharge when they leave the Minnesota Security Hospital, and we can pull them back when we need to. So a new civil commitment is not needed.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm just trying to figure out is, for the bonding request, for the numbers that you project, how many more beds you'll need in the future, if those are for new commitments or if those are for people who are out on discharge and then have to come back into the facility.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this is for the number of beds that we think we will have in a given year, which includes new people coming in and other people going out, with a net increase of, you'll see, it's around 4 or 5 a year for the security hospital. For the sex offender program, where we have the higher slope, that's new people coming in and not very many going out, which is why the slope keeps going up so much more rapidly, because you don't have the turnover.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
Thank you. And to Mr. Johnson, and I really tried to think of how I could ask this question that it would be within the purview of this committee, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to. But since we have the CFO here, I just have to bring up, we are talking about cost savings here, and I don't represent the Moose Lake area, but I'm in the same judicial district as Moose Lake. And I hear from my public defenders all the time their frustration with MSOP charging the sex offenders, the patients there with crimes, while they're at the Moose Lake facility, sometimes ranging from indecent exposure to disorderly conduct. And they get charged with these crimes, and then they have to haul them to the courthouse. They, of course, have the right to a full public defender, a full hearing, a full trial, and then they get go back to Moose Lake and transferred to St. Peter, where they're never going to get out anyways. And I think if we're talking about cost savings for these programs, I mean, to me it's absurd that we're charging people with crimes who are never going to get out anyways, and then we have to pay for the full trial. So maybe we can meet with that on a different issue. That's obviously not under the purview of this committee, but when we are talking about cost savings and how expensive this program is, that's something that I would like people to consider.
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, Representative, yes, it is a fact that when people commit crimes in our programs, whether it be when I was a deputy commissioner and a warden in corrections, we did the same thing in corrections. We have to hold people accountable, whether they're not getting out or not. And the benefit in our program of charging somebody and convicting them of a felony level offense when they're in a treatment program is that then we can revoke them and send them to prison, so they aren't getting in the way of the 87% of the people that do want to get involved in treatment. So leaving those people in a general population and ignoring criminal behavior is not consistent with developing an atmosphere that's conducive to developing a good treatment environment.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just the final comment to that, maybe I need to learn more about it to understand it better. But to me, charging a sex offender with indecent exposure while they're in a treatment program, I think goes against the treatment process and maybe helping them get them through that, and also does get very costly to the system. And from my conversations with the Department of Corrections, they have a higher level of when they would charge an incarcerated person with a crime than when they would charge a patient at the sex offender treatment program with a crime.
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would suggest that maybe we ought to look at the data. We do keep data on what we do charge out, and I would also submit that I wouldn't deny the fact that there might be an indecent exposure charge, but it's probably the 10th, 15th, 20th time. And remember, we have female staff, we have female clinicians, and again, I think that we have an obligation to hold those people accountable for that kind of behavior, and we do it within the contours of a treatment program. But last year we charged 4 people with attempted escape, but we've had some very, very serious assaults in our program, staff who have been assaulted. So there may be a case or two of indecent exposure, but most of the cases we refer to county attorneys are serious offenses.
We are going to have to wrap up real quick. There's another committee coming in, so if you could, put it in Reader's Digest form, that would
Chair,
be awesome.
Very quickly, you'll see on slide 16 the summary of what we gained from the investments in the St. Peter campus, the improved safety for staff, enhanced treatment environment, the physical separation of population, as well as obviously the new beds for the sex offender program. To the last two of the department's priorities, the third priority is asset preservation. $2.5 million is requested. You can see on this slide the 5 campuses where we would target the asset preservation work. This is really addressing aging buildings, roofs, life safety systems, windows, so forth. As I mentioned earlier, we have a list of $18 million of asset preservation projects. This will help us move toward getting some of that addressed. We did have $4.7 million appropriated in the 2011 bonding bill to address our asset preservation needs as well. And this slide just shows you what those...
Representative Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Johnson. Is this, so at the Brainerd Region Human Services Center, is that for asset preservation or is that for demo?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, I believe it's for asset preservation, correct? Yes, asset preservation. The demo money has already been appropriated and used. And then, Mr. Chair and members, our last priority is for early childhood. This is a $3.1 million request. There's existing in statute a provision that allows the Department of Human Services to receive bonding money to put out an RFP to communities for developing early childhood facilities. This has been around since, I believe, the early 90s. We've had maybe five or six cycles where we've received money and put it out for proposals. These require a 50% match. It's a competitive process. These are essentially communities that want to come together and build or develop or remodel a facility for early childhood. Often the school districts involved, sometimes the city or county, some nonprofits, potentially a community action agency. They tend to be sort of partnerships that come together for the facility purpose. The funding has been off and on over years. We did receive $1.9 million in the 2011 bonding bill for this. And you can see on the next slide a map that shows since 1992 where those facility dollars have gone when we received money under this provision. And then, Mr. Chair, the last two slides just give you a picture of the St. Peter campus. The first is the upper campus, which is, this is at the end of the master plan, in this case, in the two cycles, what we'd expect the campus to look like, the security hospital and the surrounding buildings. And then the next slide shows you the lower campus, within blue the buildings that would be used for the sex offender program, and then some shared buildings for administrative purposes between the two programs where we can get efficiencies on administration, maintenance, kitchen, and so forth.
Mr. Johnson, have you any portion of what you showed us today gone through Representative Abler's committee at all? Or?
Mr. Chair, it did go through Representative Abler's committee, and the committee did recommend all four priorities for funding.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm just curious on your proposal here, particularly the $40 million. How much of that is what we would refer to as a shovel-ready project? Because I see you have things there for design and construction. Design takes a long time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's correct. This construction would probably start early next calendar year. There is quite a bit of work to be done before we'd be in digging and doing the remodeling.
I think we're done.
Mr. Chair, I would like to address one piece of what Representative Ward said earlier. First of all, to be clear, yes, we are building new buildings. So we weren't trying to say we weren't building new buildings. I think where we're coming from with this proposal is where we kind of started was having the security hospital saying we need to start over and remodel this thing and build new kind of facility to make a better flow of treatment and have a better transition treatment for people that are in the security hospital. We had the sex offender program saying we need to build another 400 beds up at Moose Lake. That was where we were 2 years ago. And we thought, whoa, you know, what are we doing here? And where we came to with this proposal is a way to take those two needs and try to tie them together in a way that we think is a more efficient way to go forward. Using the St. Peter campus, where we have had long-term relationships with secure populations who are allowed into the community and good support from the community on that, and where we have the infrastructure, as Mr. Benson said, of the fences and the security and so forth that's needed. So we were trying to take what could have been two separate directions, each going in the range of $40 million, and make it into something that we could stage and that we thought gave us more flexibility with the sex offender program, but address what we think is a real pressing need with the security hospital.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have any of these possible use facilities in my district, so I'm just talking as just a person on the street. When you're talking about the need is for transitional apartment-type housing, we don't have to build new buildings to do that because we've got transitional apartment-type housing available, and we should be using that. And I mean, either that or some type of mobile home facility. We don't have to be spending $40 million for this. This is, we got to quit doing this. So,
Mr.
I mean, let's just try to get...
Representative Scalzi, this is the housing for people before they go back into the community. We do have the transitional housing in the community, too, and that's where folks go after they leave the campus. This is for the on-campus to get them prepared for that transition back to community. And we do use housing scattered all over the place in communities across Minnesota for the housing in the community, with supports, with supervision, and the counties generally manage those. But this is really what we need on campus before people are ready to go back into the community on a full-time basis.
Representative Scalzi.
And I just think that we could do that in Brainerd or somewhere else. I just think we could do it cheaper and not spend the 40 million. I mean, I know what you're saying. I just think we've got to save some money here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned.